wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio. It's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this January 31st Monday. This morning on the Old Mole, we talk power battles in Maine, diatribe, and the outlook in Nicaragua. We'll open today's show with Bill Resnick interviewing Matthew Cannon, a leader in the Maine Ballot Initiative campaign that successfully prohibited the construction of a super high voltage electricity line. The initiative won by a stunning margin of 60% to 40%. The Sierra Club and other sponsors of the initiative are now collecting signatures for a second initiative to take over Central Maine Power, the state's largest investor-owned utility. Following Bill Resnick and Mike Cannon, Jan Hawken talks with AJ1 about his film Diatribe, which screens this Friday evening, February 4th, at the Hollywood Theater as part of the Cascade Festival of African Films. Tracing the evolution of hip-hop dance from traditional origins in Africa, Diatribe features the music and wisdom of Ghanaian master drummer and Portland legend Oboadi. AJ1 is a filmmaker, performing artist, and historian with an emphasis on the eurythmic and oral traditions of storytelling. He has independently produced, written, and directed theater, film, and television between his roots in L.A. and the Pacific Northwest. And we conclude the Old Mole today with Luisa Martinez and author, lawyer, and peace activist Dan Kovalik. They talk about his recent trip to Nicaragua for the inauguration of President Daniel Ortega. Luisa and Dan discuss the long, dark shadow the U.S. has cast over the Nicaraguan people, the characteristics of the Nicaraguan Revolution, and possibilities for the future. I'm Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and thanks for tuning in this morning. And thanks to KBOO members old and new for supporting community radio and programs like the Old Mole. Remember, you can find us on the web. Look for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, or download the Old Mole podcast and listen on the go. And now, Bill Resnick and Matthew Cannon.
Hi, Matthew Cannon. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi, Bill. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Matthew Cannon is a director and policy man for the Maine Sierra Club. He was one of the leaders of a Maine ballot initiative that prohibited the construction of a super high voltage electricity line that won the opposition, the won by a stunning close to 60% to 40% to stop that big grid that would have brought electricity to Massachusetts, mostly from a set of immense dams in Canada, the province of Quebec. Maine would have been bisected by a huge ribbon of land that was defeated in the initiative. The initiative is being challenged in the courts by all their companies and financiers building the grid. But win or lose in the courts, the Sierra Club and all the other groups who sponsored the initiative are now collecting signatures for a second initiative to take over Central Maine Power, which is Maine's largest investor-owned utility, and replace it with a large cooperative made up of many smaller cooperatives throughout Maine who are committed to building out local sun and wind, as well as offshore wind that Maine receives along most of its periphery. Today, we'll be talking about both initiatives, why the big grid transmitting electricity from faraway dams is so destructive, and why local onshore sun and wind and offshore wind is so superior. Matt Cannon, tell us why the big grid bringing electricity from those huge dams across the border, why is it so destructive?
Thanks, Bill. And I should say that, you know, this was a multi-year initiative, grassroots movement, and I'm just a representative for the Sierra Club who worked on it, but we as a grassroots movement across the country, representing over 4 million members and supporters nationwide and 22,000 here in Maine, we partnered with folks on the ground who would be most impacted by this and the other folks in Canada. And so the biggest reasons why we oppose the corridor, the environmental impacts through untamed wilderness near the Appalachian Trail being a big reason why many groups signed on. We were probably most focused on the destructive impact of the dams, these mega dams themselves in Quebec, on the lands and rivers and the lives of Indigenous Native Canadians. So we really tried to bring light to their plight with the Canadian government over decades and the impacts that these very, very, very large reservoirs. I mean, these dams are absolutely massive, and their ecological impact really is enormous. So we were focused on that, and there's some potential methane impacts. There's lack of science on, are these really clean, non-greenhouse gas emitting projects? And then the impacts on Indigenous folks. Not to mention that it's just a very long distance, and there were folks not really consulted that well during the process.
I've read that the area covered by the dams and submerged is about the size of Vermont, which is not that big a state, but in the United States, it's a huge amount of land. And that when that occurs, submerging an enormous amount of trees and other plants, as well as all the plants on the ground and all of the ground, it leads to a biological process of decomposition. The bacteria get busy, and you get tremendous methane clouds coming out of these areas, which is, of course, really terribly happening in Siberia and other places,
right,
where enormous areas of peat and other submerged vegetation are now no longer frozen and are emitting methane. It seems it's a huge amount of greenhouse gases.
Right. And we know from studies across the world and other mega dams that that is a problem. Each climate is slightly different, but I think the lack of clear science around that and the lack of monitoring is a huge concern if we're calling these renewable energy. Additionally, I should mention another aspect to Indigenous folks up there is methylmercury poisoning. So water impounded and just contained in that reservoir has a buildup of mercury over time. And the fish source is their native food. And so they can't really eat those fish anymore because of these dams. So that is obviously a social justice concern and something that we tried to bring light to as well. And we know that there are far cheaper and less destructive, more reliable options for energy generation and supply through community energy, energy democracy, distributed generation, all these terms we use just to really focus on things that are less destructive, actually clean, and more resilient and localized.
Yeah, let's get to that, Matt. This is KB Radio. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking about Cannon of the Maine Sierra Club, one of the leaders of the Big Maine Coalition that sponsors and fought for and won a state initiative campaign that prohibited the construction of a super high voltage electricity line, a huge ribbon of denuded and herbicide land that sliced through the whole of Maine. We just discussed the environmental damage. Matt Cannon, the campaign won not just for preserving the land, as you pointed out, that it also argued there was a superior way to get off of fossil fuels and reduce greenhouse gas emissions and concentrations. You mentioned distributed energy and local energy. You have to have a vision of the electric system Maine needs in the future. How did you describe and argue for it?
Sure. Our Central Maine Power utility is rated the worst in the country, and people are very upset with many of their practices, from billing issues to resistance to solar interconnection. So I think there was a lot of just mistrust and displeasure with our utilities, which have had many years to do better and don't. Yeah, the initiative won for all the reasons we talked about, environmental, indigenous rights in Canada, and I think that idea that Mainers want more control over their own energy supply and to have a more resilient grid, which would also create more jobs in Maine. And we know we're interconnected in New England, so there's a lot of regional benefits to being interconnected to the larger grid. I don't think we could just do it as Maine independently. We do still need some transmission interconnection points, especially as we look at the Midwest for wind and offshore wind in the Northeast. There will still need to be some transmission, but I think our focus and people in Maine really want more wind and solar. We know battery storage is ramping up. Yeah, Mainers want more control. So for these projects and our initiatives, there's a lot of support for Maine Power. And actually, the state of Maine just came out with a report on how we could get there and the distribution mix. And so we know that offshore wind in Maine has a high potential. We know there's still some left for onshore Maine, especially in northern Maine. And solar is ramping up, even though we're Maine and, you know, not a ton of sun compared to other places. That healthy mix with some storage, the state has already reported we can meet our clean energy goals and go 100%. So if it can be done in Maine, it can probably be done everywhere else. And without any really new technologies, we have most of everything we need. We just need the investment right now.
This is Bill Resnick, KBOO Radio, for the Old Mill Variety Hour, talking to Matt Cannon of the Maine Sierra Club. He's the leader of a big Maine coalition that's sponsored and fought for and won a state initiative campaign that prohibited the construction of a super high voltage electricity line. You've been gathering signatures. I understand how 75% of the signatures is you're sure to go way over. Tell us about the initiative and how you would use it to build out the alternative system.
So, yeah, we just kind of framed one issue of the transmission corridor from mega dams in Canada, and our utilities, specifically Central Maine Power, through PACs and a lot of spending of our ratepayer dollars, has worked extensively to make sure that that project happens so they can make more money and uphold their contracts. And that is just keeps rubbing Mainers the wrong way, especially when Central Maine Power has been rated the worst utility in the United States for customer satisfaction 4 years in a row. We're very high up there for worst state in reliability. And as I mentioned, there's the problems with the utility slowing our integration of solar. So we have a lot of community solar that's obviously part of our distributed generation mix, creates local jobs, and the utility has slowed those interconnection agreements and has just been cutting corners. So people recognize what they're doing, and it has become clearer that they are, as a privately operated monopoly, beholden to shareholders, mostly foreign-owned. They have guaranteed profits. And people are catching on to that and wondering, why do we still have the worst customer satisfaction and the worst reliability? And so this initiative is not it's morphed over time. There's many local cooperatives across the country, especially in rural areas. This is an idea that goes back 100 years almost, the New Deal era. And these were set up because, you know, folks need electricity in rural parts of the country. And over time, it changes form. There's good examples across the country, one being Sacramento Municipal Utility District, which has their own goal of limiting all carbon emissions by 2030, and they serve a similar area of people to Maine. So that's been a model for us to look at, to how do we solve this problem of these utilities making guaranteed profits and just performing poorly. And we know we have this climate crisis, so how can we do all this at once? And so our consumer-owned utility campaign is really based on four principles: lower costs, better reliability, clean energy, and accountability. The cost, we know by taking the private utility and creating a consumer-owned utility, will save over $9 billion over 30 years. We already have examples of this in Maine. of consumer-owned utilities, and we know that Mainers who are served by investor-owned utilities pay 58% more on average for their electricity. Yeah.
58%. Well, they have
more
to serve their investors and stockholders and highly paid executives.
Yeah. I think that's the biggest thing. Obviously, people want lower rates, and they also want to know that, you know, we're accountable to our climate goals. And we know that with the savings from a consumer-owned utility, and I will mention that ourpowermaine.org has a lot more of stats and information, but in general, the goal is we want to pay a mortgage, right? We don't want to pay rent anymore. So as Mainers, if we can make a mortgage payment to our utility instead of rent payment, we'll actually own it and we'll pay less over time and we'll have assets. So the savings between paying a private utility a guaranteed rate of return of almost 12% versus paying a bond of about 3%, that's a lot of savings. That's billions of dollars. And we know that we can reinvest that in clean energy and we can have more accountability of our grid and be proud to have Pine Tree Power Company, a Maine-owned, Maine-governed board that we democratically elect. And so I think that's a very appealing concept. It's bipartisan. We have a lot of Republicans who co-sponsored the original bill. And the only reason we're at the ballot initiative is because it got vetoed in the last legislative session. But it's a bipartisan issue, and people are really psyched, which is why we're already 75% of the way there for gathering signatures.
That's great. You know, one final thing that I think our listeners should know, local energy is much more reliable than having to import energy from very long distances. Not that you don't have to have some grids and have that regional grid that can funnel electricity to you if a huge storm hits. Those are necessary. And also, even after storms, local systems are absolutely necessary in emergencies because they can be repaired generally so quickly using off-the-shelf materials, whereas big grids are only as reliable, as my sense, as their most vulnerable pylon. And that big grid you had goes over 120 rivers and through wetlands and every other conceivable geological formation. It seems to me that you can be sure that you're going to have enough electricity to keep your medicines refrigerated and have sufficient power for communications, for keeping up your cell phone and radio and other communication devices. That's a big selling point, it seems to me. This is KB Radio, Bill Resnick for the Old Moral Variety Hour. You've heard me talking to Matt Cannon of the Maine Sierra Club. They're on their way to hopefully take over the energy system, not just the Sierra Club, but a big coalition of organizations in Maine to develop a democratic and sustainable energy system. What you're doing is great. And to conclude, just tell us about the Sierra Club's Ready for 100 program. This is a national program.
Sure. As we move to the future and the vision of our grid and our climate crisis, we need to do it all at once. And this is going to be a challenge. We all know that. And citing these projects and scale and where, it's going to take a lot of work. And we do know, though, that some efficiency and weatherization methods to reduce our actual demand is a vital component as well. But yes, our Ready for 100 campaign throughout the country focuses on communities to actually reach 100% renewable energy. And we've had a lot of success in various communities, mostly cities and groups of cities that can actually make those commitments. This is a really exciting time. And, you know, we're helping communities organize and support those efforts in whatever way makes sense for those local communities. We know we just need to hit 100% clean energy as soon as possible. This is serious stuff, and we need all of us together to work on it. It takes a movement, and that's what we're committed to at the Sierra Club in all communities in a just and equitable way.
Matt Cannon, thanks a lot for talking to us today.
Thank you, Bill. It was my pleasure.
The time is near. So near, it's stirring the blood in their veins. And yet, beware. Don't let the wine go to your brains. We need a sign to rally the people, to call them to arms, to bring them in line.
You just heard Bill Resnick interviewing Matthew Cannon about politics in Maine around the struggle for local power versus investor-owned utilities. Later on The Old Mole, Luisa Martinez and author, lawyer, and peace activist Dan Kovalik discuss his recent trip to Nicaragua for the inauguration of President Daniel Ortega. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio, and this is the Old Mole Variety Hour. Next on The Old Mole, Jan Hocken talks with A.J. Wan about his film Diatribe, which screens this Friday evening, February 4th, at the Hollywood Theater as part of the Cascade Festival of African Films.
Welcome to KBOO, A.J. Wan.
Hello. Thank you for having me. This is a pleasure to be here.
Well, congratulations on your film Diatribe and the upcoming screening at the Cascade Festival of African Films here in Portland on Friday, February 4th. Produced in Portland, Diatribe explores and celebrates rap music in the United States and features Portland artists and offers a profoundly moving tribute to Ghanaian master drummer and Portland legend Obo Adi. Well, AJ, let's start with your title for this project. And I noticed midway through the film, which I so much enjoyed, you asked Obo Adi about the purpose of the documentary itself that you were making and the concept of Diatribe. Can you speak to that?
Yes. There is only 10 minutes of raw footage. And this documentary was created around that 10 minutes of raw footage. My computer, my battery died, and I went to the car to get the replacement batteries and realized I left them at the house. So I only had 10 minutes of footage.
This now, when you said footage, was it was of Obo Adi?
It was the raw footage of him in the blue shirt that said Jackson High School. This entire documentary was based around that. So we were sitting down, and I said, Obo, what do you think about these titles for the show? Beat Science. He went, I don't know. Drum Language. That's good. What about Diatribe? He said, Diatribe. What is that? And I said, it's a vicious verbal attack. It's when you're very upset, you go on this monologuous diatribe. And I said, there's no two groups in the world that have a more distorted stereotype of themselves than those born and raised on the continent and African-Americans are born and raised here in America. And I said, why don't we create a word that was once negative, and why don't we flip it on its heel and turn it into something positive and just think about the tribalism, the family, and then the Spanish word for day, which is dia. And why don't we combine those together? Let's compound the words. He said, I like that. He said, okay, let's go. Let's do it.
Yeah, that's the title is quite brilliant in its own way, in that sense you noted with Day and the tribe playing on how to think about the African diaspora and Black culture throughout the world as a tribe and, in a sense, the human tribe, but also this idea of the forceful attack, the aggressiveness,
right,
and the element of resistance to it. Can you say something about that aspect of unity through resistance that you were pursuing here?
Well, the purpose of this, Obo wanted to have hip-hop infused into his traditional set that he had done for 30 years through Homowo, through Portland Public Schools, his service with the education system in Washington and Oregon for the past 35 years. And he wanted to have something that had a little bit more of an edge, because he had collaborated with Pink Martini and Joe Thomas and a lot of artists, Eddie Harris. And he wanted to have something that reflected a more vibrant expression that came from the street. And that's why I went to go get Big Snub, Dejanay Fly, Death Row, a lot of the local hip hop artists out here. And one of the foremost best rappers in the Pacific Northwest, and Mike Crenshaw, we joined forces and created an infusion of this rebellious movement. That's again what Diatribe was representing, a diasporic tribal flavor. So compounding the word diaspora and tribe, that was why we wanted to incorporate hip hop and tell a story about it, because Oboe said he saw this form of dancing in the 30s and 40s. And I tried to correct him and say, oh, when you were 30 or 40 years old, you saw this? He said, no, 1930s, 1940s. I said, breakdancing came from the Bronx in the 80s. At least that's what I was told. He said, no, I saw this. And when he said it, I had to trust the elder. You know, he said he saw it. And me and a friend, Dr. J.D. Spinks in North Carolina, we have a nonprofit called the Department of Afro-American Research, Arts, and Culture. And it's the largest collection of Black media in the world that we have online. We're building an archive. We have an archive online. And in that, we have some race films from the 20s and 30s. And a lot of the dancing, the breakdancing that Oboe was talking about, was being performed by the Nicholas Brothers, Mabel Lee, Bill Bailey, Bojangles, the Berry Brothers. And that's the first 5 minutes. You see a montage of this breakdance from almost 100 years ago.
That montage, that historical look at movement, where you see the, not only traditions of movement and preserving joy and resilience and resistance through the body, but how innovations are introduced that also draw on earlier traditions. And of course, hip hop is known for sampling, but I think people think of it more in terms of the poetry of hip hop rather than the break dancing. But you really brought in that fusion of movement so beautifully. It itself was a kind of choreographed piece, what you did with that, the historical archival materials. It was worth the watch for that alone.
Right, right. Thank you. Thank you very much. It was imperative that we teach a lesson and we show that this dance not only was being filmed 100 years ago on film, but it stemmed from the continent. We have 54 nations in the motherland, and each one of those nations have a native dance and multiple dances within each nation. So it's important to stretch back and go into the chronology of Blackness and to use it by way of tracing traditional dance and bringing it up to the urban landscape of today. It was imperative that this documentary be a lesson to educate and to entertain as well.
Yeah, can you say a little bit about Oboe Addie, who died in 2012 and was well known locally, respected for his work as a drummer and dancer and educator? He taught in many places, including at Lewis and Clark. And you have a spoken word tribute to him at the end that was, I think, one of the most moving lamentations and memorials I've heard in quite some time. Can you say something about what he meant to you?
He meant so much. That dedication that you spoke of was kind of a subliminal indictment on the city, because I didn't think that he was given the respect that he deserved. I wanted to come away with this experience and sharing this precious time with him and with all of the work and service that he gave to the city of Portland, I wanted to move on and establish my legacy, seeing that a street, a music center, some kind of something was raised in his name or in his honor, because all he wanted to do was play his drums, and he wanted to teach people rhythm to feed the soul. That was the simplicity of everything. And he played with Miss Janice Scroggins, may she rest as well, along with their memory. That trilogy of the three of them, they were with each other for 30-something years, just really working through the city of Portland through the education system, teaching. King Neighborhood, Portland Public Schools, American Music Project, and Oboe, he was more than an uncle to me. He was someone that I wanted to spend so much more time with, and I was honored that he instilled trust in me because we were able to communicate intimately. And being able to listen to him without him having to repeat himself, I never said, what'd you say? Excuse me? I didn't hear you. Your accent is a little too thick. I made a purpose to get as close to him as possible and listen to him without him ever having to repeat himself. And that was something that instilled that trust. And when it came down time for another director or any other more popular names that had a bigger status in the city of Portland to come in or to possibly be interviewed to direct this, Oboe said, no, we got to go with one. One is going to be the one who brings this all the way through. So that trust and those small times, those little experiences that I had with him last me a lifetime.
You talk with him about the Portland scene, and there's more to it than sometimes is recognized by people in the big metro areas of the country that are more diverse than Portland. It's known to be a predominantly white place, but also a tradition of radicalism here, including Black liberation politics that go way back to the Black Panthers. And Oboe Addy talked about Portland as a place he was proud to work and perform in, and that LA and New York are not the only places with a music cultural scene, a Black cultural scene. You had a little ongoing joke about Portland. What did you want to say about Portland as a Black cultural scene?
You're not going to, don't bait me into that. It's only, let's see, there's 1 minute, or there's 2.5 minutes left here. No, I'm not even going to get into that.
You have some beautiful footage of Portland hip hop scenes. And of course, not only Mike Crenshaw, but other hip hop artists in Portland.
Portland is the place where I learned pretty much everything that I'm doing here in Hollywood. And there were so many people, I mean, countless people, men and women, leaders in the community, politically, civic and social service, that took me under their wing. And we're talking Ron Herndon, Larry Dunham, Mikhail Shabazz, Oboe, Thera, Miss Janice Scroggins. There's so many people. It's an untold amount. And Mr. Ken Berry, everyone had something to send me off with. Like, if I'm going to tell you something, this is what I'm going to tell you. And you nourish yourself with this and you implement this source of wisdom and take it all the way home. I woke up December after my mother and grandfather passed in 2019, and something told me, I think it was Oboe, tapped my shoulder and said, finish what you started. You said you were going to take this all the way. So
His spirit is in this and would certainly be shining down on you.
I know. See, the big thing for me is when I got the news that this was going to be the opening night at the Cascade Festival of African Films, and that Janice Hocken is going to interview you from Cable. Cable was my second home. I would be there every Saturday with either Celeste Carey or Eugene Rashad.
Mike Crenshaw also has a strong, deep history with KBOO.
Of course he does. That's my brother. And once I got that call, the main thing I thought, I can't cry. I was about to break down right here, just thinking about it. But I wanted to keep my word to him. The most important part of that documentary is at the end when the battery runs out. And he says, you'll write this. And he was saying, you'll write this, you're going to make this right. And you're also going to pen this. You're going to orchestrate this and make it right. And I said, right. I'll take care of it. And then the battery just turns off.
It's a profound metaphor for how much we have to find ways of keeping our energy revived and the endurance, the resilience, but also some of the fragility of struggles that require people to hold and pass them on, as you've done so well in this project. And you'll be, as I understand it, you'll be there at the Hollywood Theater Friday, February 4th for a Q&A after the screening. Is that right?
I wouldn't be any other place.
I look forward to being there as well and meeting you in person. And listeners can learn more about the Cascade Festival of African Films, the full program and screenings and the schedule by going to www.africanfilmfestival.org. And
yes,
we'll be posting that on the Old Mole website and podcast as well.
Okay. And if they also wanted to learn more about Diatribe, they can go to www.diatribe.world. And that will give a pretty good account of the basis of what it is and what it will be. Because there's a lot more to the story that many people don't know about that's in development right now.
Well, thank you so much, AJ1, for being here today. And congratulations on your film and the incredible tribute it represents to Obo Adi, as well as so many other hip-hop artists, the history they carry. I hope you carry on your own work as well.
That's the plan. Thank you very much. AJ's coming back home. I'll give you a couple of weeks. So Hollywood's going to be packed to the hilt, too.
That's right.
Oh, yeah.
Take care. We'll see you soon.
All right. Thank you very much.
You just heard Jan Hocken and A.J. Wan talking about his new film, Diatribe. It screens this Friday evening, February 4th, at the Hollywood Theater as part of the Cascade Festival of African Films. And that music there was from Oboadi, We Say. We conclude our program now with Luisa Martinez and author, lawyer, and peace activist Dan Kavalik discussing his recent trip to Nicaragua for the inauguration of President Daniel Ortega.
Hey, old moles. Today, I get the pleasure of interviewing Dan Kavalik. Dan is a U.S. human rights, labor rights lawyer, and peace activist. He's written several books, including The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, The Plot to Overthrow Venezuela, and most recently, Cancel This Book, The Progressive Case Against Cancel Culture. He's litigated cases against Coca-Cola, Drummond, and Occidental Petroleum over human rights abuses in Colombia. And he currently teaches international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. Hi, Dan.
Hey, Luisa. Glad to see you.
Likewise. You recently returned from a trip to Nicaragua, where you attended the inauguration of newly reelected President Daniel Ortega. Before we get to the significance of him, can you give us a brief history of the United States' relationship to Nicaragua?
Yeah, well, it's a fraught one. The U.S. has been intervening there since before the U.S. Civil War. But let's just start with the early 20th century. The U.S. Marines first invaded Nicaragua in 1911 to stop the liberal president then from making a deal with Japan to build a canal in Nicaragua, because the U.S. has always coveted that canal or the possibility of it. And the Marines came and went. They invaded several times in the early part of the 20th century. There was a great peasant guerrilla leader named Augusto Cesar Sandino, who managed to fend them off every time and drove them out of Nicaragua for the last time, I believe, in 1933. And then the U.S. set up a dictator named Anastasio Somoza, who lured Sandino into Managua on the promise of a peace deal, because they could never defeat Sandino. They couldn't even find him. I mean, he was so good at hiding and whatnot. So he came out to sign a peace deal, but there was no peace deal, and they shot him, Sandino's people, and his body was disappeared, never found. And the U.S. supported the dictator Somoza from 1934 till he was overthrown by the Sandinistas in 1979. The Sandinistas were founded in 1962. Of course, their namesake was Augusto Cesar Sandino. That's how they got their name, the Sandinistas. First of all, the first thing the Sandinistas did, we have to explain the nature of the Sandinistas. The Sandinistas have an interesting philosophy. It's a Christian socialist philosophy. Nicaragua never had a sizable communist party. You know, it was one of the few countries in the world that had a revolution of this type that did not have a communist, capital C communist influence. This was a unique philosophy to Nicaragua and continues to be. And one of the first things the Sandinistas did was to suspend the death penalty in Nicaragua, including for the Somocistas, the National Guardsmen, who the U.S. supported to defend Somoza's reign. And by the way, the National Guard, Somoza and the National Guard, killed 50,000 Nicaraguans during the insurrection of 1978. 50,000 out of a population then of less than 3 million people. This is a staggering number of people, including they were aerial bombing their own cities, like Masaya, the Somocistas were, with U.S. support. So first of all, let's start with this, okay? The U.S. has never supported democracy in Nicaragua. This is such a joke. And frankly, the Sandinistas' kindness and Christianity in suspending the death penalty was, as is usual, used against them by the United States. And so Jimmy Carter, the human rights president, one of the last things he did in Nicaragua was to fly out the National Guardsmen, as many National Guardsmen as he could, into Honduras in planes marked with Red Cross insignia, which is a war crime, by the way. And these would become the nucleus of the Contras. And then when Reagan took over, he and his CIA and the fascists, along with, of course, our good friends, the fascist junta in Argentina, trained and armed the Contras to restore democracy? No, to restore Somocismo without Somos. That was the goal. And so for almost 10 years, early 1980s to 1990, the U.S. supported the Contras in terrorizing Nicaragua. The Contras never gained any land. They had no support. But they did terrorize the country. They did do a good job killing doctors and priests and engineers and destroying schools and electrical plants and raping and murdering people. And all told, about 30,000 Nicaraguans were killed by the Contra War on top of the 50,000 killed by Somoza. Okay, so you're talking 80,000 people, again, out of a population of 3 million. In 1984, the Sandinistas held the first free and fair elections in Nicaragua in many, many, many decades. They won those free and fair elections. And then in 1990, which I think gets us to our next question, the Sandinistas held early elections and were defeated by Violeta Chamorro, and they stepped aside and allowed Violeta Chamorro to become president. All demonstrate one huge fact. The Sandinistas brought democracy to Nicaragua, while the U.S. brought dictatorship and tried to restore it once that dictatorship was overthrown.
Thanks for that background. Can you give us some insight into Violeta Chamorro's election as president from 90 to 97?
Yes, well, that was not a free and fair election. But it was not a free and fair election, not because of the activities of the Sandinistas, but because of the activities of the United States. The U.S. made it clear to the Nicaraguan people, and they made it clear, by the way, in person, because they had the U.S. ambassador to Nicaragua actually go around with the campaign to tell the Nicaraguans what the deal was before the election. And the deal was this: if the Nicaraguans voted for the Sandinistas, the U.S. would continue the Contra War, would continue sanctions against Nicaragua, which would continue the economic blockade, and would give no humanitarian aid to Nicaragua. If, on the other hand, the Nicaraguan people voted for Chamorro, the Contra War would end, the blockade would end, the sanctions would end, and the U.S. would give humanitarian aid. So essentially, the U.S. held a gun to the Nicaraguan people's heads, and coerced as they were, they voted for Chamorro. And I remember that election, you know, people were not happy. There was not dancing in the street. This was a vote of exhaustion, of coercion, but that's what happened.
Okay, so shifting gears a little bit, you said that you've traveled there a number of times since the 1980s, and you've written extensively about the Nicaraguan Revolution. Can you give us some insight into the nature of it? Like, what programs have you seen develop since you've been going there?
Well, first of all, you know, the first time I went there was in 1987. I was 19 years old. And what really struck me was the incredible poverty, you know, because one, the Sandinistas inherited an economic basket case and a country in Somoza plundered the country, including on his way out. He stole billions of dollars. And the Sandinistas really weren't able to do much to start building Nicaragua because of the Contra War, right? And so 1987 was a very dark time because the Contra War had been going on. People were tired. People were beginning to lose hope. And they were poor. You know, you saw children in rags, literally rags with no shoes. That's a big thing in Latin America or the developing world, whether kids have shoes or not, really shows a lot about the country. And they did, by and large. Most of the roads were not paved. They were dirt roads. Again, regarding the children, I remember being at a restaurant in Managua, and these kids, I mean, just scores of kids came up to the window banging for food. This is not something you see anymore. Okay, kids are going to school because the Sandinistas brought education. They brought health care. They have paved those roads. They have built highways. They've now connected Managua to Bluefields out in the Atlantic coast with a beautiful highway. it is a developed country now. And by the way, it's developed now after Ortega was reelected in 2006, because between 1990 and 2006, when the neoliberals, beginning with Chamorro, were running the government, they did not electrify the country. About 50% of the country remained unelectrified. They didn't do infrastructure. They had a train system. I just learned this recently that Chamorro just sold off. They ended the free education and the free health care of the Sandinistas that had come before. When Ortega comes back in 2007, he begins electrifying the country. It's now nearly 100% electrified. It now has free Wi-Fi in most of the country. The free education, the free health care were reinstated. Poverty alleviation programs began again. Even the World Bank and IMF applauded these programs. And so this is what I've seen. I've seen a country develop from, you know, a very poor country to a prosperous one. I'll say one last thing. Nicaragua for 3 years in a row has been ranked by the United Nations fifth in the world for gender equality. The U.S. isn't even in the top 10. The first four are like the usual suspects, Finland, Sweden, you know, Norway, Denmark, you know. It's an incredible feat. And so they should be applauded for that.
So let me ask, and this is an important question, because there have been allegations that President Ortega, he's arrested his opponents prior to the presidential elections in November 2021. Can you kind of address this criticism that has come both from the right and the left?
Yeah, well, first of all, let me say that Nicaragua has never, ever had the type of purge or terror that other revolutions have had, right? The French Revolution, the Chinese, the Russian, even the Cuban, right? Where they did have these kind of summary trials and Comandante Che Guevara lined some people up and had them shot. I'm sure they deserved it, by the way. Well, the Sandinistas never did that, okay? And that's important to point out. So they've allowed these enemies of the people to run around, to receive money from the U.S., to cause violence like they did in 2018, in which 200 people were killed in brutal violence. The NED admitted that they helped lay the groundwork for that insurrection, that again killed 200 people. And so the Sandinistas have actually been quite patient and forgiving. Well, finally, in the summer of 2021, Ortega, or the Sandinista government, did arrest a number of people who they claimed were receiving money from the U.S. to do essentially work for the U.S. in trying to overthrow the government of Daniel Ortega, without, by the way, reporting that they were receiving those monies. That is a violation of Nicaraguan law, which is actually based on the U.S. FARA law, the Foreign Agent Reporting Act, which we have as well. So they arrested people for violating that. They also arrested people who they claimed were intellectual authors of the violence in 2018. And they arrested some people who also, their intelligence said, were planning a coup that year.
Okay. And so briefly, in the last couple minutes that we have, can you address that President Ortega has restored trade relationships with the People's Republic of China? Can you explain the significance of this action and the possibility that it presents to the Nicaraguan people?
Yeah, well, it's a huge deal. First of all, let me just say, so Daniel Ortega was reelected in November. I was an observer there. 65% of the Nicaraguan people electorate voted. 75% voted for Ortega. And there were six parties run. I need to point that out. So he won by a huge margin in a contested election, which shows he has a man, in my opinion. And yes, he recognized the People's Republic of China for the first time since 1990. The Sandinistas had, in the early days, recognized the People's Republic. That when Chamorro came in, she recognized Taiwan. And the Sandinistas, once reelected in 2006, continued the recognition of Taiwan, mostly for economic reasons. Finally, Daniel decided, because Taiwan was not doing what he thought was appropriate, and that was making peace with the mainland China, he recognized the PRC reestablished diplomatic relationship with the PRC and has restored economic relations, and announced at the inauguration that he would now be part of the Belt Road Project of China. This is huge. First of all, the Monroe Doctrine, right, of 1823, in which the U.S. claims it has sole dominion over the Western Hemisphere. It does not allow others from the outside of the hemisphere to have influence. And under the Roosevelt corollary, the U.S. claims it can actually go to war to stop others like China now from having that type of influence. So first of all, it's a declaration of independence from the United States. But also, it's going to help with development, and it may even bring this canal, which the U.S. tried to stop Nicaragua from having with the help of Japan. Now the Nicaraguans are going to be able to help. You have the help of China to do this. China's going to help build roads, maybe rebuild that train that Chamorro gave away. So it's an incredible thing, both symbolically, but also economically for Nicaragua.
Wonderful. Thanks so much for your time, Dan.
It is always my pleasure. Nicaragua is near and dear to my heart. I'm happy to talk about it and defend it to all comers. So thank you for the opportunity.
You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Community Radio. That's 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio. A big thank you to KBOO staff who have kept our non-commercial community radio on the air 24/7 over these last 2 years. It takes a labor. The Old Mole comes to you every Monday morning at 9 a.m. And thanks to our contributors and guests for making today's show possible, Bill Resnick and Matthew Cannon, Luisa Martinez and Dan Kovalik, and Jan Hawken and AJ One. Thanks to Patricia Kohlberg for her PR magic. You can hear The Old Mole on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, or download the Old Mole podcast and listen on the go. The Old Mole burrows down to the roots of the great issues of our time, the struggles of ordinary people for democratic and sustainable ways of life. I am Denise Morris, and I've been your host this morning. Tune in next week for more news, views, and interviews from a socialist, feminist, anti-racist perspective.